Welcome to our Open Research Podcast. We invite you to join us in our audio space here at Sheffield Hallam University to dive into more in-depth discussions around open research. I'm Tommy Smithson from the Library Research Support Team. Today, we invited our members of the Organizing Committee for OpenFest 2025 to talk about EEDI principles in open research. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us in the studio. Would you mind introducing yourselves?
Hi, I'm Jenny Adams. I'm the Open Research Manager at the University of Sheffield, based in the University Library.
Hello, I'm Jim Utley. I'm a lecturer in Architectural Science in the School of Architecture and Landscape at University of Sheffield, and I lead the Open Research Working Group at Sheffield as well.
Hi, I'm Keith Fields. I'm Head of Research Excellence and Impact at Sheffield Hallam University. I'm the REF Manager, and I'm the Professional Services Lead for Ethics and Integrity.
I'm Pete Smith. I'm a Research Support Librarian in the Library Team at Sheffield Hallam.
We promote our OpenFest as our flagship celebration and exploration of open research, where we provide that opportunity to explore current issues around openness and transparency, share experiences, and consider how open research can be applied in different disciplines. We are joining this online space all together to talk about diversity in open data and metadata for representative research, building inclusive relationships with research participants. We are talking about the movement towards an equitable, inclusive, and bibliodiverse publishing ecosystem, about inclusive approaches to research recognition and building diverse open research networks and communities, and finally changing the research culture, introducing positive change. The very first question today in our podcast, I would like to ask Jenny. You are advocating for EEDI to be the main theme for this year's event. May I ask why? Why EEDI?
Yeah, I think this is an important issue in open research, mm-hmm. and it intersects so many different aspects of open research, from open access to bibliodiversity to ensuring that data is representative of varied communities. And the data relating to marginalized communities is both safeguarded and also shared or not shared according to the wishes of those communities as well. So it's an incredibly relevant topic within all aspects of open research. But I think as well, it's particularly topical at the moment when we're seeing that in some national contexts, research and data relating to marginalized communities is under threat and is in some instances being deleted from government databases and becoming less accessible, and also pressures placed on what is considered acceptable and fundable research. So it feels like a time to be taking a moment to examine those issues and to consider how the ways that we think about and support open research can also push back against some of those pressures and support that kind of diverse and inclusive research environment that we want to have.
Mm-hmm. Everyone should feel confident in bringing their authentic selves, ideas and perspectives to the research table. Inclusion is about that sense of belonging for all. Having our colleagues from academic libraries, I would like to ask about inclusive community building. So to what extent are libraries in a unique position to facilitate that inclusive community building around open research?
So I think libraries definitely are in a unique position to facilitate that. Libraries will often have dedicated roles, like myself and colleagues from Sheffield Hallam, who actually have that time and space and workload, and in some instances resource or funding perhaps, mm-hmm. to dedicate to building and supporting those communities. Whereas for academic staff, it's often squeezed out in the weight of other workload and other demands on those roles. So to have those dedicated roles is really important. And also to have a space that stands beyond specific disciplines, a more kind of interdisciplinary space where we can have conversations with people from a range of different subject areas and types of research, and to support those people to have conversations with each other, it's really important.
Mm-hmm. Pete, do you have anything to add?
You've probably heard the concept of vocational awe within libraries, and it can be very easy to think, hey, we're librarians, we're great, we're open, but we're not immune to propaganda, we're not immune to the structural forces around us. You look at the Library of Congress, for example, changing subject headings around, let's say, geographical indicators, and we know that libraries can just as easily support, encourage, help things that are not inclusive and equitable. So a key part about that practice is being reflective and honest with ourselves about how we do this. Are we leading or are we listening? Mm-hmm. Are we talking to, talking with, or talking down sometimes? So we just, it's a very important thing. Jenny's absolutely right. I don't want to say it isn't, I think, but it is important to consider how we do it And we'll come on to that, I'm sure, throughout the conversation about things like about being genuinely collaborative and open and listening in a way that sometimes librarians haven't always been.
So libraries, they can support that on a meso level. What about the bigger picture? I'm thinking about the macro level. Let's talk about our institutional strategies to support EEDI. Sheffield Hallam, back in 2021, introduced 5 Hallam values: ambition, collaboration, inclusion, innovation, and integrity, to represent those beliefs, philosophies, and principles that help transform lives and foster a culture of inclusion. What articulates that vision is the EDI framework. It describes what we are aiming for. So there are 3 indicators set for that: experience, visibility, and impact. So experience means that people at Hallam experience an inclusive environment where they feel they belong. Visibility is about a clear, coherent, and visible commitment to EEDI, and impact shapes our focus on activities that are measurable and impactful. Do you have any strategy in place at the University in Sheffield?
We do, and in a way it's very comparable. If you have your 5 values, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
We have our 4 pillars, and one of those is One University, and we'll speak about that in just a moment, but to say the other ones are research, education, and innovation. So the One University pillar includes diversity and inclusion and all kind of sub-policies within those themes, but also trying to create a collaborative culture, the theme of well-being and supporting staff and students, sustainability with the environmental concerns, and philanthropy as well. So thinking One University kind of echoes out into the city, the notion of a civic university and being embedded in your community. So all of those things are kind of connected within that theme of One University. And I think sometimes it's easy to be quite skeptical about these institutional commitments, particularly where they have very broad words that kind of encompass the different areas. But something that I've been really pleased to see at Sheffield is the fact that this has manifested in concrete mm-hmm. initiatives. And perhaps one of the ones that's most relevant for this discussion is the research culture strategy, which has sought to create kind of actionable frameworks mm-hmm. around how we can actually improve the research culture at the institution, which includes things like commitments to technicians and furthering the support for research technical professionals, and also commitments around supporting open research practices.
Mm-hmm. And academic library support encompasses a wide range of services like literature searching, referencing, research data management, publishing, dissemination, and more. But as libraries, research enablers, how can we find the balance between providing a central service to researcher, delivering those key institutional messages, but also making our support as specific and responsive as it can be to individual research areas, methods, and approaches? Jenny, could you discuss the data steward service at Sheffield?
So the data steward service is something that we piloted a year or so ago. We experimented with giving tailored support to specific projects, so not just even specific disciplinary communities, but to specific individuals or groups from particular areas who'd come to us with a very specific set of questions or problems relating to their research projects. So it might be, here is my participatory research project, I'm working with these creative people, we have these issues of intellectual property, how can we deal with those, how can we address those in things like data sharing? And in many cases the library team needed to go away and actually find what is the appropriate guidance for that specific situation, and then to work with the groups to develop their practice, but also to develop our guidance as an institution, so that we're then providing that level of nuance in the guidance that we give to make it applicable to not just quantitative and STEM research, which often is the kind of the bias in guidance, but to a really wide range of research types and people trying to do different things.
Mm-hmm. That leads nicely into my next question. When we are discussing that tailored support, can we talk about the language that we use, that inclusive language across the university? I'm thinking about the way how we communicate the vocabulary, the terms like data or data management. So do we, maybe not indirectly, but unintentionally alienate specific communities of researchers?
I think we absolutely do risk that with the vocabulary of things like data management, data sharing. Mm-hmm. My research background is in the arts and humanities, and I would never have conceived of the materials that I was gathering and creating as data. And if somebody started talking to me about data at that stage in my career, I think I would have immediately switched off and thought, this is nothing to do with me. This is mm-hmm. not a process that I need
it's
to engage
relatable.
In
yeah.
at all. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's not relevant. So I think this is something I want to explore as part of the new role that I'm moving into, which is with the Materialising Open Research Practices in the Humanities and Social Sciences project. We'll be looking at things like questions of language, how people conceive of their data and its shareability. So yeah, that issue of language and terminology I think is really interesting, and it's trying to find the right ways by engaging with researchers about how they conceive of their materials, trying to find the right ways to talk about that in order to have a kind of productive conversation that helps people to reflect on and perhaps improve their practice. Previously, I've thought about this in terms of non-publication research output, but I think that term in itself is perhaps confusing and possibly a bit excessively functional. So at the moment, I'm thinking more in terms of gathered and created materials, because this idea of gathering to me suggests the kind of ethics of care that goes into data collection in things like ethnography or co-production, working with particular communities, and perhaps is less dehumanizing or scientistic than mm-hmm. the concept of data. But it is something that I'm looking forward to exploring further.
I think there's something about what we understand by research. I remember a former colleague of ours, bless her memory, she and I would talk about our respective research. And quite often, half joking, she would say, I don't even think what you do is research, Pete. It was so different to mm-hmm. what she was used to. And it's about the language of how people discuss what they do and what they think they're doing is where we meet people. So on the one hand, here at Hallam, we do have STEM-type research in biosciences and materials engineering, and then we have very creative practice and process. And maybe that's the kind of language we need to think about, is what is your process? What are you doing? And what kind of things do you create along the way as part of that process? And which of those things would help somebody else understand your process? Mm-hmm. So we don't necessarily use the language of replication, because that's a very specific language for a very particular problem in a very specific area. But we understand about portability, perhaps. How can we move one piece of research from one place to another? What do we need to do that? In some cases, that is several terabytes of observational data. In other cases, it's my scribbled notebooks from my visit to a prison. I just happen to know a researcher who did some work in prisons, but they're an artist. So we had very interesting discussions around, what does data management mean for me? We don't necessarily need to get hung up about, oh, we need a different word for data. It's just, how do we articulate in those different contexts? You might spend a lot of time and energy trying to find a different word for data, and what you might spend some of that time and energy on is reminding yourself in each context to articulate with these people, at this moment in this process, data means this or could mean this. And you ask people, okay, what does data look like in your film work?
I think that sort of neatly encapsulates this difference between like equity as opposed to equality. So like that recognition that different disciplines will use different terminology, different words for the kind of things that they produce in the research, and not necessarily assuming that there has to be one generic word that is used across all of the academy, because that doesn't really acknowledge the sort of the, you know, variations in people's contexts and disciplinary norms and sort of the types of research that they're doing.
Absolutely. You know, it's that challenge we have, I think, going back to one of Domi's points, we're a central service. So we have a page about data management, and that's relatively easy to keep up to date. If we have 15 different pages about different kinds of things, that might be more helpful, but we have to think about how that then affects our own practice, especially as non-specialists. For most people, we're not specialists in their particular area. So I just remembered, I've looked up the vocational or mm-hmm. for Bazzi et al. There mm-hmm. we go. So we'll splice that in earlier so they get the credit they deserve. We can be very practical and say, look, I'm here to talk about data management because you've got UKRI funding, they ask for it, but you're AHRC funded, so what does that really mean for you when your work is creating things? Mm. And to some extent, it's like the stuff that informs the things that you say. If we boil research down to some profane gloop, we say it's about, I have looked at a thing, I have found some things out about it, I think it means these things, and I am telling you about them. And then that all looks radically different depending on the thing you're looking at and the way you've come to understand it. And we in the library might say, well, okay, it's relatively easy to support somebody doing nuclear physics, because we can kind of vaguely understand that. Somebody doing something that's much more ethnographic, for example, we need to work with them to understand it a bit more.
I think we broadly agree, Pete, but I would maybe say that there's something politically significant in the act of translation, that we say data and there's no translation that's required. Yeah. And then for other researchers and research type, we need to translate. And then there is an element of things being refracted through a particular set of assumptions about what research is that is perhaps disempowering.
Yeah, there's an Italian pithy phrase, traduttore traditore, I think, is, which is a translator is a traitor.
Interesting.
Because in translating, you are making choices about what word do I think best captures that word in this context. It may not completely, because of the cultural baggage that comes with it.
Yeah, that's the question of power.
Yeah, we're in a relative position of power sometimes because we're supporting people and we're telling them kind of what to do or guiding them in what to do. And that comes back to that listening earlier, that we listen to people and say, if somebody says talking about data isn't useful to us, we have to have the appropriate sort of humility and understanding to say, well, okay, well, what would work for you here? What in this translation process, you translate it for us and we will use the language that works for you, like the whole open research, open science choice, for example.
I think the language is so important, and thinking about inclusivity and kind of incorporating all variations of the research ecosystem into what we're trying to do. Language can be so alienating, and speaking from personal experience working in the School of Architecture and Landscape, it's very sort of multidisciplinary. On the one extreme, you have sort of humanities people doing archival research or something, and the other extreme, you have engineers kind of working on very technical research data. And I can see immediately, you know, as soon as you start talking about open data, for example, certain colleagues immediately switch off because they don't see themselves as collecting data, as how that might be perceived. So finding the right terminology and language, I think, is so important, making sure that, you know,
the message resonates with everyone.
Absolutely, yeah.
I had that in this podcast as well with our guests, where they were even seeing people from different disciplines working on transdisciplinary projects, having completely different understanding of what certain resources were, like mapping things. They had different backgrounds, so their perception was definitely influenced by their own context. So it's nice when we promote that kind of collaborative approach that people learn from each other as well. But moving on to the research design, EEDI, thinking about the cultural resistance to change, social inequalities, power dynamics, financial, and those language barriers we were just talking about, ethical and privacy concerns as well. Why should we encourage to incorporate that EEDI approach? And more importantly, what do you think are the risks if we do not do it?
A lot of EEDI work in universities is top down, and it's about ensuring the diversity of the research team, which is really important to make sure that our researchers look like the general population and represent that. But this is the more kind of organic way that we can embed EEDI into everything we do, that every researcher can do. And the reason for doing it is actually, well, there's lots of reasons for doing it, but it's actually to get better data, to do better research. So there's reasons why certain groups don't participate in research, or their data is missing from our data sets. So some of it is about what we call non-participation. So this is people, and this is quite often minoritized groups, that they're less willing to participate in research. They're actively less willing to do that. And this is because of sort of levels of distrust, because of historic bad experiences and things like that. And then there's also sort of sometimes issues from the researcher's side, which this is what we call inadvertent exclusion. So this is where researchers perhaps don't get into harder to reach groups as much as they could. They sort of rely on environments and areas that they're comfortable in. And both of those can lead to these groups kind of missing from the data. So in all our governance frameworks, we're really encouraged to take account of protected characteristics and research design, research undertaking. And the thing you mentioned in your question, the risk of what goes wrong if we don't do this. So in terms of ethnicity in particular, it can really limit the efficiency of some of our research. So just an example, something like sort of personalized medicines and things like that, we're actually limiting our biological understanding of some of the data if we've got ethnic groups missing from the data. And a similar thing actually relates to the use of females in research. So for an awful long time, up until more recently than you'd like to think, a lot of drugs were never tested on women. And the reasons for this are quite bizarre sometimes. So some of it's to do with animal houses and animal testing. And it just cost twice as much to keep male and female animals. So they just went for one sex. And they tended to choose males because, I'm going to read this out because I find this quite funny, because of concerns about the fluctuating hormones and reproductive systems and how they might confound studies. So it's quite a Victorian attitude to why a lot of primate trials and other animals were only ever tested on males, and then they brought that into human trials as well. So that kind of behaviour actually only stopped happening in around the 1990s. So a lot of historic drugs, sort of stuff developed after the Second World War all the way through, were never tested properly on females. It's just those kind of flaws in research designs and why we need to be much more inclusive of our population. It just makes better products, better drugs and better research.
Looking at public engagement, as I have, one of the reasons for collaborative and co-production design speaks to what Keith said, that it's considered to be ethically better because you're not simply doing research on people, but you're doing research with people and you're understanding what they need to know from this research. And it speaks to some of those historical distrust issues that you're very open open research about what's going to go on. And assessing those gaps, so there's a well-known ethnicity gap around things like blood gas monitors that don't work on darker skin, for example, those sorts of things. The more and broader range of people in any kind of research, if you want to apply it, which at Hallam we do, then it's going to be more applicable in a wider range of circumstances. So it's ethically also jargon. It's ontologically better because you're covering a wider range of people. So, you're getting a better coverage of the population, and it's often felt to be methodologically more sound as well because you're getting that broader, richer field of data.
And I think the example that you use, Pete, really illustrates the fact that research that is not informed by a consideration of EEDI factors then goes on to perpetuate those systems of oppression in which certain people are not catered to as equally or equitably by the medical establishment, as one example, whether that's particular ethnic groups or particular biological categories of people.
I was reading recently about gender bias in research and things, and a really good example that was mentioned was around when they were doing research about the road traffic crashes and the use of seatbelts, when they were developing seatbelt legislation, that kind of thing, I think it was. And in the the crash tests that they were doing, they were using a crash test dummy, but it was based on the male body. And so all the findings were based on that. In the end, I can't remember the statistic, it was maybe something like women involved in crashes suffered 50% more severe injuries than men because the seatbelts had been designed based on a male crash test dummy. So it's just examples like that of these various biases within research that littered, I think, throughout different topics and areas.
And to pick up on Jenny's point, it is about how things get embedded and reproduced over time. One of my friends, his daughter in America, is doing research into maternal mortality amongst African American women, which is phenomenally high, using phenomenal in its sense of really bad, because the research, the attitudes that underpin the research, therefore inform the treatment or lack of treatment. And you see it the same with pain as well. The risk, what do we mean by risk here? So there's the risk that the research isn't as good or as meaningful. There's the reputational, relational risk, the risk Keith mentioned earlier, that we can't recruit people. If we don't change, we're not going to recruit more people because we can't demonstrate that we're not the same as we were before with some of these medical trials.
One of the areas of my research is looking at the influence of lighting on perceptions of safety, and trying to make sure we have the right lighting that is going to encourage people to feel safe, because if they feel safe, they're more likely to walk, and etc. So one of the types of studies we do is we get people to walk down different streets that are lit in different ways and ask them to rate how safe they feel, and then use that data to then say, okay, to reach the the optimal level of feeling of safety, we need this much light, essentially. And as a good researcher, you try to get a representative sample of participants, which means a gender balanced sample. All the evidence tends to show that women in general feel less safe to walk at night than men do. And so the problem there is, if you have a 50% split in males and females, and you take the average ratings of safety, that's going to be the average of the men and women. And so essentially, if you then design your lighting based on that average, it's almost like you're setting the light level so it's fine for men, but it's not
still
applicable
not fair
to women.
Yeah.
So really what we should be doing is having actually a non-representative sample, actually having probably focusing more on a female sample.
Reach a scale where everyone just feels safe.
Everyone feels safe, precisely, yeah. Hold my hands up there. That's something we've failed to do.
So what's the next step to...
Well, yeah, this is the next step, I guess, would be to...
Maybe redesign.
Redesign. have a different sample of participants and trying to design lighting to meet the sort of the average perception of safety, but actually, because that would still kind of exclude a significant proportion of people, but actually design lighting so you're meeting the needs of 90% of people as opposed to sort of 50% if you're using a sort of average.
Mm-hmm. I have another question for you, Jim. Let's talk about the culture change versus challenging financial times. So considering the cost of open access publishing, data management, infrastructures, institutional incentives to fund recognized open research practices, how can we motivate researchers to embrace more open practices when morale is understandably low and workloads are higher than ever?
I think a key thing is highlighting the benefits. Obviously, as an open research advocate, I'm going to say open research in general tends to be better research. And so if we can highlight, clearly that's a generalization, but I would argue research that tends to be done in an open way, all the benefits of kind of open research tends to lead to more rigorous, applicable, inclusive research. And so by highlighting the benefits of doing open research and how that leads to improved research, improved outcomes, and more significant, more relatable findings, we can hopefully persuade researchers that this is a good thing to do. I think from an institutional perspective, institutions need to acknowledge sometimes the extra effort, the extra time, the resources that might be required for doing sort of good quality research. And I think there's starting to be a shift away from the whole, you know, publish or perish kind of perspective and more towards quality over quantity. So, for example, REF, kind of looking at your most impressive, your most significant, your highest quality outputs that you might submit to REF, as opposed to here's 20 articles I've written in the last 5 years. So there is that move towards that, which I think can support institutions to persuade researchers that this is the way forward.
Mm-hmm. You're the lecturer in architectural science, and I'm wondering if your perception of open research has changed when you started being involved in those Open Research Champions Network, open research initiatives.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I first kind of became aware of open research as a concept, I suppose, I was looking at it very much through my disciplinary lens as a sort of quantitative psychologist, I suppose. You know, and ideas around reproducibility, open data, pre-registration, all these kind of ideas that tend to be more of a STEM-focused kind of concepts.
But you're moving from quantity to quality?
Yes, absolutely. So being involved in things like the Open Research Champions community, where it's very multidisciplinary. You know, we have champions, orcs from across the different faculties at the university, and it kind of makes you much more aware of the range of issues that researchers are facing from different disciplines who are using different types of methods, not just kind of quantitative, experiment-based, large data set analysis types of issues. Involvement in those kind of cross-disciplinary communities is really valuable for ensuring that you are aware of the limitations, I suppose, perhaps, of open research in certain disciplines, and you're not sort of painting everybody with the same brush.
So when we are wondering how we can motivate researchers, could you give us some advice?
You know, everybody wants to be acknowledged and recognized in their career, to seek promotion. So trying to embed the acknowledgement and recognition of sort of open research and carrying out research in an inclusive and equitable way into kind of rewards and recognition systems in the institution is really important. At Sheffield, I think we're moving towards that, like in our promotion criteria. So just to give you an example, I was in a session a few months ago that was talking about the promotion process at Sheffield. We were talking about evidencing high quality research outputs. Senior strategic leader at the university was saying, well, you know, you can use journal impact factors, you can use citation rates as evidence of high quality, even though kind of the university is a signatory to DORA, you know, where we're supposed to move away from those types of metrics of measuring quality.
But looking, for example, at the journal impact factor, it presents several ethical concerns in research. For example, that pressure on researchers to prioritize publication in high impact journals. There is a light in the tunnel. We can see an increasing movement towards seeking ways to measure the openness of research, to shift the dial away from more problematic means of research assessment, such as that journal impact factor. So the question is, to what extent will this create its own problems? Does measuring need to be a dimension for the movement towards a more open research culture?
personally, I think measuring possibly does need to be part of that process of recognising and rewarding and incentivising open practices, because how can you recognise what you're unable to kind of see is happening? I guess also recognising where support is needed in order to advance in particular areas. But then you need to think very carefully about what it means to measure something. And I think taking quite a broad view of measurement might be advantageous in terms of not narrowing down to here are our numerical measures of research openness. That is, oh, in this discipline you've published 25 data sets and in this discipline you've only published 2. That is very reductive, that fails to recognize the differences in what practices are possible in different areas. So I think, yes, perhaps measuring has a role, but we need to be very careful when we're kind of designing and thinking about what those systems of measurement are, that they don't exclude certain kinds of practice that might, in a sense, contribute to the devaluation of whole spheres of research and spheres of kind of ways of knowing things and investigating things. Because we already have this kind of hierarchy of disciplines or hierarchy of what research is considered monetarily valuable by the government, what ought people to be studying at the universities, and this is towards STEM subjects and engineering and medicine, in which open practices perhaps are easier to measure, as opposed to practice-based, arts-based subjects, qualitative research areas, where it's less, the products of research might themselves be less tangible if it's, for example, a culture change or building something with a community that is an initiative whose impact is harder to measure. So I think, yeah, we need to, particularly at this point in time, with the REF PCE indicators, people, culture and environment, which I know Keith might want to speak about. It's a moment of reflection and it's a moment for getting it right so that we don't cause this kind of hierarchization of disciplines or of research types that then further entrenches those inequalities of regard and esteem and financial support as well and funding that currently exist.
What is driving improvements in research quality and culture? That external key driver for research quality and impact here in UK is REF, and I'm looking at Keith now. You and Professor Wayne Crunton agreed that REF is a sort of a big vehicle driving research excellence, but it can also be used to achieve lots of other things. It can drive lots of other positive agendas. And the fundamental motivation of what we do collectively is to support our community of staff, students and partners to undertake research that makes a difference. So a couple of questions here. Firstly, what is the role of REF policy and requirements in catalyzing the movement to openness?
It's interesting. See, yeah, REF traditionally has kind of used policy as a lever for things like this. So when open access came in and the last REF, it was a compliance thing. It was your output should be available within 3 months and embargo periods and stuff like that. So it was a compliance thing. That works sort of relatively well. They've changed it this time. The emphasis is going to be much more about culture change. So in terms of the compliance thing, the output side, there's been minor changes, so they're halving the embargo periods and they're switching from date of acceptance to date of publication. It's sort of minor sort of trimming, and they actually didn't go forward with some of the other policy stuff we thought they would in terms of long form publications being made open access, which we think they pulled back from that because of financial reasons, the extra cost of the APCs and things like that. So they're not using policy as a lever this time. What they're doing instead is using this other element that's sort of been touched on before, people, culture and environment, or PCE. This is where sort of universities kind of account for their culture, the inputs they put into research and its score. It accounts for a quarter of the mark of REF. And it's a new framework that they're playing with this time. It has 5 sections, but the 2 sort of most of interest to the open research agenda. There's one on responsibility, so this covers all of ethics and integrity, but also a lot of the reproducibility agendas in there. And then the second one's about connectivity, which open access is in there, alongside things like academic external engagement and knowledge exchange. Universities are going to be given quite a broad kind of area to respond to this, sort of under those headings, sort of where are you at in this area? So what's your baseline? What interventions have you done? What's been your engagement in these areas? Have you evaluated it? What have been the outcomes? So it's a chance for universities to tell their stories, mostly in the past, but also looking forward into the future. So in that responsibility thing, it's covering things like policies. Do we have good policies about open research? What's our training like? What external activity do we do? What sort of networks do we have, like our champions networks, what we do with the UKRN, that kind of thing? How do we recognise roles, like ethics leads roles, resourced and recognised sort of in job titles and things? And then some other stats, what's the download levels of data sets, how are they being accessed, those kind of things. So that's in the responsibility section. Then in the connectivity thing, it's a chance for us to present our open access compliance, our adherence to the FAIR principles. And again, like I was saying in the previous section, our recognition of the roles. So are our open champions sort of visible? Are they resourced? Are they recognised in their sort of appraisals for doing those roles? Are the promotion criteria, those type of things? It's quite a broad thing. We've got these sections to fill in with kind of all the good work we're doing there. But hopefully that's kind of motivations for universities to now think, and we're going to be scored on this. This is going to be important. What can we do to genuinely improve the culture in those areas?
Mm-hmm. You were talking about open access compliance as a panelist for the next REF. Could you tell us what are your reflections on the lack of the REF mandate for either open access book publishing or open data?
No, it's interesting. I think especially around books, I think a lot of the hostility has come from the community itself. There's been a lot of nervousness around it, especially sort of arts and humanities. It's always been written into the guidance that there's going to be an exemption for trade books, but I know because a lot of those do have books for sale in Waterstones and stuff like that, they're quite concerned that if it's mandated, it's sort of free and online, they're going to lose that small kind of income revenue. I do think they pull back for financial reasons, because if publishers aren't making as much money from these books, universities need to pay the APCs, they're quite expensive, and just the state of sort of finance for HE at the moment, I think that was why they pulled back. It wasn't a decision that this isn't an important thing. So I think it's actually been deferred, and they're quite firm that those are going to come in from about 2029-2030 for the next draft. So they are coming, they've just been deferred because of the financial situation. And yeah, the data sets is interesting. Sort of, I think they are going for the approach of show us some good practice rather than compliance, just because I think maybe the agenda isn't as advanced as it is in sort of with publications and stuff like that. It's probably a bit too early, and the infrastructure, the attitudes aren't quite there yet.
Mm-hmm. And what are the panelists' hopes and concerns relating to the PCE, the People, Culture, Environment indicators?
I think the hopes are that it's actually going to measure culture rather than infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So the way environment in the last REF was dealt with, it was how much money in have you got and how big are your buildings and your labs and things like this. This new design, it's much more going to reward, okay, we've looked, we've identified the problems, we've invested, we've done something, we've evaluated it, and we've got some evidence that we've changed culture. So it is kind of encouraging kind of deeper behaviours and reflection. So that's the hope. I think that the concern is maybe if you're going to be quite open with this and say, what's your direction of travel? What have you done? How you compare different universities is quite hard. Sort of, you can't really have comparability of data if you're presenting different stories. You haven't got the same data. So how do you score them? I think there's enough sort of sophistication, and sort of definitely from what I've seen inside a pilot panel, there's so much sort of rigor and thoughtfulness around this, and I'm quite confident it'll be really well done.
Mm-hmm. I don't have any other questions today, but when we advocate for EEDI, should we just explain what we mean by equity, equality, diversity, and inclusion in research? Equity. Let's start with that, Pete.
Equity is about moving away from rules-based kind of approaches and structures to more narrative, individual, sort of what's happening in front of us approaches, for want of a better phrase.
Mm-hmm.
So historically, equity has been associated with equally fuzzy notions like fairness and what is appropriate in this situation. If there's a particularly rigid rule in place that might lead to injustice, what can we do to remedy that? And that should lead us to consider changing the rules. So if, to go back to our earlier examples, in our hospital wards, black women get less pain relief or get less good maternal care, the equitable position would be to devote resources and time to understanding that and improving it, rather than saying, well, everybody gets the same care, everybody's equal, everybody's getting the same thing. It's for me to look at, but what is actually happening within our systems, and what do we need to do to ensure that we are at an equal point where everybody's getting the same standard of care? And sometimes that's recognising that the same standard of care isn't what's appropriate, that there is maybe a more individualistic, mm-hmm. that's the issue. So for me, that equity, equality distinction is about equality. It can often be a formal statement of intent, and we do the same for everybody, and we're not making distinctions. Equity is recognising that sometimes distinctions do need to be made, either to remedy historical wrongs or to prevent future ones.
what equality stands for.
Just trying to think about what this means in the exact context of open research.
Open access. Have the same access to resources and opportunities. We open up the research findings. We disseminate the knowledge outside of academia.
That's a really good example that if something is open access, there is an equality of accessibility to researchers at really well-funded universities in the global north, but also researchers in institutions where funding is more of a challenge, where there aren't necessarily subscriptions to the journals, that currently researchers are often paying out of their own pocket to access articles that they need for their research. So the open access context seems like a really good for the concept of equality.
Mm-hmm. Any other examples?
I think you were talking about it, Jenny, about actually ensuring that the open research agenda itself is equal, and there is this a thought that perhaps, you know, for example, like measuring certain open research indicators, perhaps that is going to favour or prejudice certain disciplines, and it's within sort of the research community and within this the kind of the open research agenda, ensuring that it is discussed and applied equally and fairly across different groups of research and different disciplines.
Equal opportunities through open access is one bit. There's also education to support people understand that material. So absolutely open access, is that sort of necessary but not sufficient sort of thing. There are other things that go with it. So you make the papers available, but as the work that Domi's done around adding plain English summaries, those things, or putting something on a web page to say, well, here's what this means for you.
Absolutely. It's thinking, what does equality of access to knowledge actually look like? And definitely open access publishing is the first step. But as you say, there's accessible and there's accessible, isn't there, when it comes to something that's written in a very abstruse language, the language that we talk to each other as researchers in, versus the language that most people
everyday language
conversant in. Exactly.
And it's that part of equity is about thinking about the place that you're in. So talking one academic to another, using technical language is an efficient way of communicating because you understand each other. Talking to members of the public, you need to think about translating it. So it's not just about everything must be in the plainest English language possible. It's about when is that helpful.
So I'm massively in favour of kind of simple explanations of research that anyone could understand. There's also a danger, though, that often you might find that when people are explaining their research or want to describe it to a public audience, there's a risk that people might over-exaggerate the impact and benefits or what they've done. I've done that in the past. You know, I've given public presentations and I've said, this research is great, it's going to have, you know, all this implications because you're selling your research in a way. And there's something to be mindful of, that we should be talking to the public about our research, but not over-egging it.
I think universities have got that big problem with sending out press releases, and then it gets picked up in the press and does become, yes, amazing new discovery, this one thing will cure whatever, and it's maybe more nuanced than that. And to go back to our measures thing earlier, and to pick up on something that Keith works on here, it is about narratives and about stories sometimes. It's about taking out from all the research that you do what's a sort of compelling and accurate, come back to Jim's point, accurate and honest, but nevertheless compelling account of what you've done and what it means. It's what we're looking at in terms of sort of measures, as it were, is, and then it depends where we're telling that story as to what language we use and what medium.
I think to follow on from that point about storytelling, it seems very interesting that the implicit hierarchy in research itself between quantitative and qualitative research is reflected in the arena of research assessment and the preference for numerical measures or things that can be ultimately transferred into numerical measures. Whereas actually, as qualitative researchers or as diverse research communities, we need to emphasize the value and the irreducibility sometimes of findings and narratives or accounts that are qualitative in nature, and the fact that those cannot be simply kind of, okay, this means that this is a numerical grade on a spreadsheet or a table, and to reassert the value and the importance of that.
I really love that a national research assessment exercise talks about things that are being world-leading. And then it has three different levels of international. You know, what is world-leading, what is internationally significant. I was doing a session for a university assessment, and it's about, if your research is, essentially, if your research is perceived to be parochial, if it can't be expressed globally, it's going to be reviewed less. But there's some research that is about a place, and the meaning comes from it being about that place. It doesn't matter that it can't be applied in every part of the globe. Sometimes it's about this story is important to these people. Maybe it can tell us something about the human condition. Discuss. So that's a separate thing about the nature of the ref itself and how we're assessed and how we have to do a dance. Ref people have gone to a central training thing and have come back and started saying, talk about the originality, significance and rigour of this work and talk about its international world-leading kind of stuff.
Well, this seems to link very interestingly to open science and the sort of origins of the open science movement, partly being against a rejection of the idea that we have to bury our null results or our results of minimal significance, and only the most significant and dazzling and startling results are publishable. So there's a reproduction of that kind of problematic cluster of thoughts.
Well, is that word significant? What do you mean there? Because a null result might be significant. It actually tell you something you didn't suspect. You might say, well, this is not worth pursuing, or this is worth pursuing, but in a different way. So there is a premium on earth-shattering and revelatory, whereas a lot of research by its nature is processual thing and it's kind of cumulative. And every so often somebody will come along and have an amazing breakthrough.
It's that idea that, you know, I heard somebody say, if everybody did groundbreaking research, then we'd just end up with a load of holes in the ground and, like, nothing to build it on.
And from an equity equality point of view, not everybody's in a position to do that because of their career stage, because of various protected characteristics. Where you are and what you're doing is going to inform whether you can produce what's regarded as 4-star. So any kind of assessment process almost inevitably produces perverse incentives and distorting factors. And a lot of it is about how you live within that system to do the things you love and the things that have meaning to you, and then hope that somebody somewhere along the way will be able to buff it up for a ref or a tef or a kef, all the Fs as somebody wants it, submission.
The last two things, diversity and inclusion, I think that's an easy one, because open research is about creating that space for a wide range of different characteristics, backgrounds, perspectives in research. And inclusion is about everyone feeling welcome, valued, respected and empowered to be part of it. It's about that sense of belonging for all. So I think with this EEDI theme for OpenFest 2025, we can now invite everyone listening to join us for sessions hosted online, and for everyone listening later on, after September 2025, all the recordings will be added to the episode description so we can rewatch the sessions and learn more about open research. Thank you everyone for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Tommy. Thank you.
You have now reached the end of another episode of our Open Research Podcast. Next time, we'll talk to Professor Andrea Wakefield, our Director of Center for Loneliness Studies, and her open practice, priorities in research, media presence, and how you can grow impact from your research. So please stay.